Okay, let's move on to the practical issues. And can you talk about the clinical trials that have been done with bevacizumab in breast cancer?
The first one was the monotherapy trial that looked at 75 patients sequentially enrolled in three different dose cohorts. Overall, it was an objective response rate of about 9% and about 17% of patients who were responding or stable at 5 months, which is a little bit unconventional time point, but that was one of the time points that the protocol required that you evaluate their disease. So we know that that's a solid endpoint. And four of those 75 patients were treated for at least a year without progression. That led to a randomized trial in patients with refractory disease looking at either capecitabine alone or capecitabine with bevacizumab. That trial required patients to have had previous therapy with an anthracycline and a taxane, and they actually could have had up to two previous chemotherapies for metastatic disease, so they were a pretty advanced group. That trial enrolled 462 patients and found essentially a doubling of response rates by adding bevacizumab. But that doubling went from 9% to 19% in the eyes of the independent review facility. It went from about 19% to 30% in the eyes of the investigators. But those low response rates really did not budge the median progression-free survivals, which was the primary endpoint of that trial, and did not alter the overall survival.
While you're mentioning that, Lee Ellis makes the point that a number of trials in different tumors have shown increased response rates. Why do you think you see an increased response rate with this agent based on the mechanism of action?
I think there are a couple of potential reasons. One is if the increase in perfusion in the short term actually does result in greater delivery of the chemotherapy, that's one potential explanation. Though that wouldn't explain the few patients that we saw who had objective responses to monotherapy with an anti-angiogenic agent. We know that some solid tumors do express the VEGF receptors on the cancer cells, so if those are providing growth or survival signals, then blocking that might be important. There is actually some laboratory evidence for that, that if you increase VEGF in the culture media, cells tend to become more resistant to chemotherapy. And if you block VEGF, you can restore the sensitivity. So that may be part of the reason as well. And we've sort of come to think of VEGF as one of the mechanisms of chemotherapy resistance. So if you eliminate that, you give patients the same opportunity to respond. And it may also be truly through the anti-angiogenic effect that you are killing the same number of cells with the chemotherapy, but preventing some of the cells that are resistant to the chemotherapy from growing as rapidly because they can't get the same blood supply. And in some patients, that difference between growth fractions and death fractions could result in a partial response that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Before we go on to the other studies, given its pretty favorable side effects profile, do you think that there's a role for monotherapy in the clinical setting?
I think it's difficult to propose monotherapy. I mean, we certainly saw some activity in those heavily pretreated patients, but it was very modest and a very few number of patients. If you have somebody who is heavily pretreated and still in good shape and able to get the drug, I don't have any major objections. But I don't think that's using the drug in the way that would be most beneficial for patients. And our clinical trial data certainly shows that the earlier you use this drug in the natural history of the disease, the more likely patients are to benefit and the more prolonged that benefit will be.